everybody again. We're continuing afternoon session. On the agenda now is the Disclosure Initiative Project, in particular the proposed amendments to the IS-7 debt reconciliation, not only debt reconciliation, also cash. This is actually a project that found its origin, I think, from a letter of the Crown, 8 years ago.
Equipment.
2006.
Yeah, that's at least a period. But I really give the floor to the staff to present the
Okay. Okay, so I'll take you through this part of the presentation.
Okay, so I'm Eduardo. This is agenda paper 5. And I'm going to go through the slides and stop at the questions. And we also have a taxonomy part because of these amendments. Also have a taxonomy discussion. And when you're talking about taxonomy, I'm going to pass over to Rita. Okay. So as Martin already mentioned, a known subject, and this is a bit of a comeback paper to the CIMAC because we already discussed this in CIMAC some time ago. And the proposals, that's something I'd like to make it very clear, the proposals are to improve debt disclosures, but not to improve all the problems we have with disclosures on debt now. So it's a narrow scope amendment. And if we could move to slide 2, this is just a quick overview of the Disclosure Initiative and where this proposed amendment sits in. And I think we have another section after this to discuss in more detail all of the projects in the Disclosure Initiative. So in slide 3, just to give a bit of background, I'm going to be very quick about it, we have received feedback several times of requests for debt disclosure. And specifically, historically, the requests have been targeted to a net debt reconciliation. And we have the agenda consultation of the ASB, the discussion forum for the feedback, and the feedback statement for the disclosure forum in 2013. We have had also CIMAC discussions and other investor surveys, and we ended up with the publication of the exposure draft in December last year. And I'm going to talk a little more about the proposals further on. So if I can move to slide 4. Quickly talk about what are the objectives we were aiming for. So we aim for these amendments with two objectives. And first of them, to improve the disclosures on debt, specifically to understand. We chose to stick with one thing, is understanding the movements in debt. And the second thing was to better understand the liquidity, because part of the discussion, the previous discussion on debt, was when you present a net debt reconciliation could be slightly misleading if you net the cash and don't show what would be cash possible, existing cash restrictions, because cash is not always available to use by the entity. So the ISB decided that if we want to move with a debt reconciliation, information on cash restrictions should also follow together. So if I could dive a little more into the proposal in slide 5. So we discussed a net debt reconciliation approach, and we understood that defining debt could be problematic, it could be very time consuming. So we went with an option that we call in the financing activities approach, and we'll discuss that in detail in slide 6. And as I said, we're going to approach the other amendment on cash restrictions that has to go together with this financing activities approach. So in slide 6, this is the proposal of the amendment, and we have a slide, a small example of what is sitting in the exposure draft. And the proposal basically talks that every balance sheet item that includes assets and includes liabilities that would have cash flow flowing through the financing activities in the cash flow statement should be reconciled in this amendment. So we see here in the example, we have long-term borrowings and lease liabilities. So these are two examples, and those are the examples that were already sitting in 97 on our standard. So these are the two line items that would be balance sheet items that would have to be reconciled And when I'm saying reconcile back, if we look at the columns, let me go a little bit in the columns. The first column and the last column are going to be balance sheet columns, so those numbers are in the balance sheet. The second column is the cash flow column, and that column would sit normally in the cash flow statement already as well. But the third and the fourth column are what we are calling new information that could not be easily found or not even found in financial statements, and those are the non-cash changes. So you have to reconcile the previous period to the end period, all those balance sheet items. Now, just a brief comment I want to make on this example. We can see that non-cash changes columns are only for acquisition. What we mean by acquisition is business combination. So here we had a debt acquired by business combination and new leases. But in the amendment, in the text of the amendment, we also mentioned forex exchanges and fair value changes and liabilities. So the columns are not restricted to this one. These are just the examples.
And first, just to make sure, 200 of the acquisition on the borrowings, that's probably not the financing of the acquisition, but it's the financing in the target already there that resides when you acquire it.
So
it's
acquired
debt.
Okay, good. It's not financing equity because that would be shown in the cash flow statement. If you attract new debt, that would be shown in the cash flow statement.
It's not. It's a non-cash relation.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't.
So it's you acquired 200 million of debt in the.
It's a subsidiary.
Yes.
No, yeah.
Okay.
It's not an acquisition. That could be confusing because when you say acquisition, you could think you acquired debt, but you're borrowing.
You acquire a subsidiary with
debt.
Exactly.
So this brief introduction, and if you have further questions on the example, please do ask us. In slide 7, we have the first question. And we proposed this type of example in the last CIMAC meeting, and we have received feedback from you that this information would be useful, and we'd like to see entities disclosing that. And question one is, do you still agree with this view? And question two, if you have further suggestions for the amendments. So we'd like to open for answering those questions.
Okay, that's a great question. So, the first question, anyone? Can I get the floor to Barbara?
No.
No.
Well, go ahead. Peter. I'll talk after.
I'll simply yes, I still agree. There's no other way to put it. I think this is a smooth way to try to solve the problem, the debt in particular.
Anyone else? Barbara?
So I wanted to remind the CMAQ. So we brought the CMAQ this when this was not a proposal. So I know you've heard it already, and I know everyone already said that. Now we're bringing it to you as a proposal. And it was something that came from investors. So this is this is a direct response to investors that the board is trying to do through a shorter term amendment. And so it's important to hear your views on these specific proposals and if you think they're helpful or they're not helpful. Because it's an example of us trying to respond to an investor request in a reasonable manner. So we need to know what this is providing.
Just one quick question. The lease liabilities line in the example we've given there, that's presumably the finance leases.
Yeah.
Just trying to understand, the operating leases clearly has been an ongoing project for a while. Is the intention that operating leases would be included in this, and how would there be a separate line item? Or
So the example we have today, it approaches the line items of finance leases.
Yeah.
So the leases project is issuing some amendments to change that line item, and it's going to be just leases liabilities.
So it'll be the combined current financing and operating leases?
Yeah.
But because operating leases don't today generate
a
financing category with the definition, you won't get that as part of reconciliation. You'd have to do that adjustment yourself.
But once that kicks in, that line item would then go up?
It'll be inclusive, yes.
Okay. And then would that be restated?
Okay. Alan, please.
It's a question, actually, because I know the original request was for a net debt reconciliation. One of the major difficulties of doing that is for us to define net debt, because it's managed different ways. I'm curious as to, by mandating or requiring this disclosure, do you think that will actually encourage or you'll get more net debt reconciliations emerging, because people say, well, actually, that's not quite the way I manage my finances, so we actually have a trickle-down effect. I'm just curious as to your perception of that.
Okay.
My point, I know you try to make it as restricted as possible to make it easier to define, but there are other lines that are similar to that, like pension fund deficits or earn-out liabilities or acquisition liabilities that may come up in other lines that are as important as that. I'm not sure if companies will, maybe some will, some will not. So, but many times pension fund is as big as a debt. So. And they may be, allocated in different jurisdictions with exchange rate effects, all these kind of things.
Peter Yost.
I like this. The header, is it going to be non-cash changes? Is that what you have in mind? Because the acquisition of the debt could have happened for cash, right?
Would have been in the cash flow statement then.
Yeah.
In CFI, not CFI.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So we would
expect. Well, what I'm just saying, it's kind of a misnomer because there is cash involved.
That it would be a cash change. Yeah, because
but
you would
for
actually.
Me,
yeah.
No.
I suppose we wanted the disclosure to split between the cash flow changes because you could reconcile that to the cash flow statement and from the non cash changes. So if it's a cash flow change, even though it's an acquisition, would see that go through the cash flow statement. So ultimately an entity is going to have to use its judgment how it pulls together those line items and its columns, and it's going to be based on materiality and providing useful information. But I would expect there would be a line in the
acquisition. Well, it's just that when acquisitions, it's always that problem. Right? Cash out is CFI and then the rest is split up with CFO and CFO.
Peter.
I just wanted to respond to Alan. I think this will improve the discipline among companies. In Sweden, roughly 80-90% of the companies actually present some kind of interest-bearing debt reconciliation or presentation, net debt presentation, and so on. And I think that the problem is, of course, as Carlos pointed out, whether the pension liability is included or not, it will not help us in that way. It's a separate matter, but definitely to have something in the standard to point at to the other 20% that really don't give you the information, or the 15-20% that actually give you some kind of information that you really don't trust, and so on. I think this will help, definitely. It will discipline the producers.
Okay. Glenn?
So just on the point that Carlos made and Peter made, in many jurisdictions where large non-cash liabilities are actually part of the ongoing economic obligations of the business, so nuclear provisions that are unfunded, pension provisions, nuclear provisions, huge items in some companies, these are normally treated by rating agencies as if they were debt and affect the credit rating. So you would expect that kind of thing to appear, if not necessarily in a net debt note, somewhere very near to a net debt note, because it's a very similar concept. Because I'm thinking of French companies, German companies, all carry very large nuclear liabilities on their balance sheets and are treated basically by the rating agencies as if they were debt. And I know the German companies, when they talk about debt, they talk about economic net debt, and they have a schedule that looks very similar to this. They already reconcile something like this. So,
but where do you find the cost for the debt?
So they're discounted, and they include the interest as the economic interest. So it flows through the financing statements, just like it's treated just like a form of debt.
It's an interest cost on the liability that they present.
In the interest, net interest income, net interest expense, there's a further line, economic interest, which will be the provision. Obviously, the pension you could treat pensions in the same way because they're also discounted, but obviously there's a whole standard that applies to that, which is separate. But on this, in this particular case, that flows through the financing line. So it's a very, very big item for the, I mean.
But they would not present the change in that liability during financing and cash flow statement, because if they do, they need to include it in this reconciliation.
Yeah, well, I think to all intents and purposes, they don't, obviously they're not going to call it cash because it isn't cash, but to all intents and purposes, treat it as if it were economic debt and there's a follow through in treatment.
So,
right,
this reconciliation will only capture, if you like, items where the eventual cash flow will be represented in the financing activities in the cash flow statement. So for that example with provisions, if the cash flow was in operating, for example, and interest, well, we go through the operating line and the actual payment, it may not be captured in this reconciliation.
So the danger is that if you introduce a standard that doesn't cater for that, that what we have now in the treatment will disappear. So we'll have a mismatch between what the rating agencies do and what the accounts do, which we don't have at the moment. That's the point I was highlighting.
I think what we would hope would happen, and maybe it goes to Alan's point, that if an entity currently discloses debt, what it thinks is debt,
yes,
in a reconciliation like that, and that is different from what this is disclosing, I think it would be relevant information and would be still appropriate for the entity to add an additional line item to say, these are our financing activities and this is another line item that we consider debt, and to make that disclosure. And I wouldn't think there's anything in our proposal to prevent an entity adding to what is required.
Except for power plants, nuclear power plants, is there any other asset you can think of that has this kind of 30, 40 year provision?
Pension.
Right.
Pension is pension.
Provision.
Right.
There's a big mine closure.
Oil rigs, yeah. Fence farm, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they all present it the way you presented it to us?
No.
So we still have the problem with comparability today?
Yes,
so
they don't.
No.
Okay. Acquisition payables?
Mm-hmm. That's, to me, a separate matter.
I think...
it's a liability.
I'd like to highlight that this overview, it highlights that there's actually at the moment a bit of a problem, a challenge at least, for users of financial statements to reconcile the cash flow statement to the balance sheet, to the financial position. And the line items do not always match. So if you observe a line item in the cash flow statement, it's not always crystal clear to what line to what financial position line item it relates to. And usually that's just not necessary. And I think it would add to the understandability of the cash flow statement if the granularity matches the granularity of the balance sheet. And the descriptions. This actually is one way to do that. I mean, here we see the line items in the financial position and their effect on the cash flow. I expect those cash flows to be from the cash flow statement. So there's the reason. So this makes it more transparent. There is one caveat that may not be covered if there's not a change in a financial liability, it may not appear in this reconciliation. So if you want to know what through the eyes of management is considered financial debt, and you look at this overview, it may be incomplete, because at that particular year there may not have been a change. So, and I do worry a bit about that, because investors may interpret this schedule as being complete. Oh, so these are what is considered the financial liabilities of the company.
I didn't think that would be so great.
It's 1,040 at the start and at the end, will it still not be?
No, I would think if there were material changes, but say they were offsetting, so you had a large cash change and a large non-cash change, but they were offsetting.
Actually, no change.
But so no there was change. No movement at
yeah.
all, so
yeah.
there was no...
You had a billion of borrowings at the beginning of the year, and you had a billion of borrowings at the end of the year. It would not be here.
But if you've got $1 billion of borrowing, there's no way they can change something in it.
The standard says that cash flows would be classified.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't have to be. I think it would still be in there.
It would still be in there, yeah.
Would be.
The standard uses both.
So you don't
words.
Have to have a cash flow line item in that period.
So a line item that stands,
A
line item that stands still. If the cash flow that would flow from them would be classified as a finance, when it flows,
so
it would have to be.
So if the long-term borrowing was 1,040 at the beginning and the end of the year, you'd have it in the opening and the closing, no movement in any of the line items.
There's
no movement.
Yeah.
Just because there was no cash flow during the year, or there was a. No movement because, say, you had a zero coupon bond and there was no cash, so there wasn't movement.
Yes.
It would still go through there even though there was no cash flow that hit the cash flow statement. It's the when the cash flow occurs on that liability or in some cases asset, it would go through the financing.
Mm-hmm.
It would be in the scope required.
I think this is a through the eyes of management assessment of what they consider financial debt to me. Why not?
No, this is, you say it's through the eyes of management. You have no choice. If it's classified as financing in the cash flow statement, that's your book, and that's what you have to present.
Yeah.
Net debt through the eyes of management, whether you bring in those other liabilities and include or exclude pensions, that's through the eyes of management. But if it's classified there, you have to include the reconciliation.
Management has discretion on whether to classify it as financing flows or as investment flows.
Correct, there's some
so
discretion, but it's
there's a through the eyes of management element in there. I see it as I still think that's interesting and valid to know. So it's.
Japanese users are not necessarily familiar with your proposal. Martin, I mentioned that probably that we are happy with more disclosure based upon the management, the management eyes. And we want to know that how the management manages the debts and net debts. And alternatively, that some people Japanese users believe that we need some more disclosure like outstanding of debt by instrument, by maturity, or by currency. We probably need this kind of additional disclosure to make the analysis through this debt disclosure more effective.
That might be a quite demanding, but that's our view.
Okay, Peter.
I just wanted to build on what you said and go back to that header. I would call this changes not reflected in cash from financing. Because they are cash. Some of this stuff will be cash if it's due to acquisition. Just like companies show us what organic growth in inventories is when they have done acquisitions. And so it's a technicality, but there is it's not non-cash. It's just not reflected there where you wanted to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And you said this is the point of this is to reconcile statement of cash flow with balance sheet.
Yeah.
Well,
I agree. It's not reflected in your shows. Anyone else? I'd like to raise another point, and that is that this is valuable information, but. We discussed earlier today information about group structure, and I think the attention that the ISB gives to giving more insight on debt on group structure, I think is something that has been overlooked for a bit, maybe for too long, and I think the attention is valid, and I think there are big steps to be made here. Also on the year-end position of debt, what is actually what is the debt outstanding? What's the group structure? Where is the debt located? It's quite intertwined, but this is a targeted improvement, which I support. But there's more to do than just this, I think. And also from our earlier discussions earlier today, I think this is one way to address it. Mark,
just one question. Slide 6, we talk about a reconciliation of balance sheet items with cash flows classified as financing activities. I see cash flow statements. Sometimes the financing charge is in the cash flow from operations. Sometimes it's down in the financing section. Is this going to, if we look at the provisions, for example, those finance expenses will go through the income statement. Now I'm trying to think whether they would be sitting in the operating line or whether they'd be sitting in the financing part of the cash flow statement. And are we going to see shifts of expenses from the financing section of the cash flow statement into the operating part of the cash flow statement as a result of this definition? And I'm not sure I know the answer, but I just threw it out there just to see if that's something that was on your agenda.
I don't think we considered whether entities would respond to sort of perhaps not do this reconciliation by reclassifying cash flows out of financing into operating. But if a cash flow, I mean, this is going to catch all the cash flows, the underlying liabilities or assets where the cash flows go through the financing line. So if the liability contains some cash flows, ultimate cash flows, some of which may go through operating, so interest might go through operating, but the underlying principal goes through financing, and the balance sheet item contains some of that interest, I would expect the interest accrual to actually go through this reconciliation, even though that cash flow is in operating. But I wouldn't expect people to change their view of financing activities purely as a result of this proposal, because if they do that, they're actually responding to sort of achieve an accounting result, if you like. That was a bit of a two-pronged answer. I don't know if it responded to your question.
Okay. We can move on to the next. So if we can move to the next amendment, this is slide 8, and is cash and cash equivalents and the restrictions in cash. And we talked about this, so cash balances in finance, in consolidated financial statements maybe not 100% available, so summarizing, that's the problem we're trying to address partially here. So the proposal we have in the standard, let me read the wording here, just clarifies. An entity should disclose information about cash and cash equivalents, such as restrictions that affect decisions of an entity to use cash and cash equivalent balances that are relevant to understanding the liquidity. So restrictions that would affect decisions. And the question we have in slide 9, and I think we have had some very, very good feedback on this amendment here, and I think CMEC has also discussed this in previous meetings. So if I can ask question 3, do you think that the proposal disclosure will help investors better understand liquidity? If you don't think so, why not? Would be useful to understand liquidity, this kind of disclosure.
Robert. My understanding is that one of the rating agencies has put a much simpler test to this. They basically say at year end, if the money is a deposit in the treasury account of the parent, it was restricted. That'll capture one. Now that's one way of capturing it. And the second piece that you need to, so It's a long way of saying. And then the second piece you need to understand is that, let's say you have $100 million in a subsidiary that is you own 60% of it. From a cat, even if you have access to that $100 million, the way you're going to get the $100 million from subsidiary to parent is through a dividend, and there will be a kick out of $40 million. I'm getting a nod, which means you've thought about it, and it's going to get worked into the system, and that's fine.
So the concern is that I'm just
seeing how would people interpret this, and I could see this getting interpreted to say, well, you know, we have access to most of the cash, therefore it's all ours. When in fact, in the examples I've given, a lot of that cash doesn't. If it didn't get to the global treasury office in New York at year end, so that they could pay down corporate debt, they didn't have access to it. And there's a lot of cash that gets caught in subsidiaries. And the second piece is you have to factor in for minority shareholders. So it's a good idea, but when it gets written out, you need to really flesh out some of this.
Peter.
The situation that I have come across in this respect is actually when, in particular, construction companies, but also other companies, are working with advances from customers that they pay upfront. Like you sign a contract and you get 20% upfront. And that is not liquidity, that is working capital to be used in the line of business, constructing whatever it is you must construct. And to me, that cash is included today in the cash position. And if I calculate the net debt and deduct that portion of the cash, I get a too optimistic picture of the debt situation. Then, of course, it's an easy way around this. Don't reduce the debt. Don't calculate the net debt. Include the interest income in operating earnings and value it from there. But I'm not sure whether that situation is covered in this statement, such as restrictions that affect the decisions of an entity to use. It would definitely be helpful in a construction company to understand how much of the cash is actually up from advances from customers. Probably a lot of other problems also that I have come across, but this is the most frequent one.
I like the proposal a lot. I think the intention for the cash position is a miracle that on any line item in the financial statement there's hardly ever any note on the cash position. This will to some extent address it. What is missing, I think, in the current description, that you need to take a viewpoint. Not so much like restrictions in general, but to what extent is the ultimate reporting entity, the ultimate parent, the highest entity within the reporting group, able to access this cash? I think that point of view is currently missing. If you leave it blank, people will interpret, well, it's available in that part of the group. Without any restriction, you can use it, whatever. But from an investor perspective, we look at cash. We want to know what part of the cash is available in the top entity. And I'm missing that element in the definition. And in the ED, I think there is an example mentioned about repatriation taxes. If you mention an example, I think that's good. I mean, it's but you should mention quite a lot more, including what Robert said about NCI leakage. You should mention a little bit more examples, or none, but not just repatriation taxes. You could also list, for example, what costs must be made to liquidate near cash to cash and then upstream, and what costs must be made to and should it be within 3 months, you know? I mean, should it be available in the parent in 20 years? Or should it be available within 3 months? In what time frame? Cache, we have a time frame of 3 months in mind, but it should also be available within 3 months all the way down from the sub to the parent. And there are, I think it's a little bit too limited in guiding. But I think the direction is just spot on, so I really support the project. Yeah, good.
So I just want to follow up on a point, draw out a point, because I think the point you make is a very important one, and it's I think there's a broader point in the reporting of cash and debt that hasn't been addressed right now, which is this issue about, which also Robert mentioned in a slightly different way, which was because we consolidate accounts, and the rule for consolidation allows for us to deduct minority items, we're not always looking. The consolidated debt does not always give you the credit of the entity. The credit of the entity depends on what is the liability of various structures. And if you have subsidiaries that hold debt and have minorities in there, so that's the cash point that Robert's making, you're not actually looking at the underlying credit picture of the entity. And this can sometimes be extremely misleading. So the market will look at something and say, well, it's over-levered, because they look at the consolidated debt, but there's no way to work out where that debt is. So this is a waterfall problem, so it's a cascade problem, but it's also a question of how much of that liability attaches to the equity holders of that particular business. And you're doing the cash here in this particular question, so also the cash. So there's some of it will be trapped if it's a cash, but some of the debt is not an obligation, if you see what I mean. So maybe one thing that one could do at some point in the financial statements, to show of the net debt, how much of it is in subsidiaries that are not fully controlled. That's quite an important piece of information. And you could go on and how much of the debt and the cash is in subsidiaries that are not fully controlled. Because that would give you the piece of information that you're looking for about US companies and their offshore cash positions. But going back to my nuclear example, a lot of those companies that have these great big nuclear liabilities also have policies. I don't know whether they're external or internal policies to hold cash back against those long-term liabilities. So that cash is, strictly speaking, trapped, even though it's sitting at the parent entity. I don't know whether you would say that affects the decisions, because I suppose the manager would argue that at some points, you know, they can relax the policy. But it's really interesting for an investor to understand that what appears to be massive liquidity in some of these companies is actually there because they haven't funded their provisions, and so the two are kind of associated treatments.
Okay, Marietta?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to your wish list, Martijn. I would really like to see a geographic breakdown of the cash, where it's actually located. I once had a conversation with the CFO who did tell me that in a lot of emerging markets, you actually have significant restrictions in terms of repatriating the cash to your parent company, and it actually influences behavior in the M&A space. And I tried to take that discussion up with a lot of other CFOs who immediately said, no, there's no issue, don't worry about it, we can repatriate all of our cash. So this made me very suspicious. And I think, you know, but it would be nice to already know what is the cash that they, as of the balance sheet date or as of the accounts date, they could send to their parents without any restrictions whatsoever. But I think we also live in a world where any day you can see additional capital controls, governments thinking up new ways of taxing enterprises and so forth. So I just think you need to have a feel for, you know, where there might be cash that could potentially become restricted. And definitely whenever you can only repatriate cash with a significant tax penalty, that should also be disclosed.
Okay, thank you, Maria. Carlos, please.
Yeah, I think you probably need to have a more strict definition, because you know, we are trying to define what's trapped cash, right? It's not a very technical term, but it tells you a lot. And for example, if you have credit agreements, shareholder agreements, subsidiaries, you may have a lot of cash under that subsidiary, but that may depend on, even a minority can veto the distribution of cash. So for example, in this example, you could say all cash that is doesn't depend on third parties to get back to the parent company. And I'm not sure if your definition would get that. And echoing to Robert's comment, it would be one way to Glenn, if you could get, you know, how much of the debt and how much of the cash is not fully owned, you know, I think that's a big step, because then you get an idea about, you know, how much of the cash is not really yours.
Yeah, if I can quickly reply on that, we currently have requirements now for us in the case of NCI. So for non-controlling interests in other companies, you have to disclose some kinds of restrictions you have on cash. So if you have a subsidiary that you have non-controlling interests in it, and you have restrictions to access its cash, you have to disclose that. It's kind of a new standard, so for us as well. But we think this requirement, the way that's written, we have received some feedback to say, well, we already have that requirement for us. That's enough for us. Still, we don't need this one. But it wouldn't capture branches and other types of restrictions that are not related to NCI companies, in a way.
If I remember, it's about current assets and not specifically about cash.
It's not specific.
But I think what maybe we could, it says cash or other assets.
Yes, it's
the same. So I think one of the things maybe we could think about we've already got a lot of requirements which I think relate to a lot of the issues you're talking about. So one thing we could look at doing is example or educational material to illustrate some of these scenarios to explain that's what we meant when we wrote these words.
Yeah, I was really talking about, you know, entities that you control, but you may not have 100%. The right to repatriate.
Yeah,
it's
in here. It's already in there, actually.
Is that okay, Peter, please.
What was my? Yeah, I was listening very carefully. To me, to get into this kind of minority swamp is very difficult, because then we also need to get a minority portion in operating earnings, and it never ends. So I think it's really dangerous. I think you're getting into something that you cannot really solve. The non-controlling interests are small. Very small. Come to Sweden. Work as an equity analyst, then you don't need to bother about minority interests. But also, when I listen to you all, I think my view is becoming more and more stop calculating net. If there are that many restrictions to cash, it's better to have it left as working capital in the balance sheet, include the interest income, and if the company don't want or can't distribute the cash as a dividend, that's a penalty on the valuation.
I wasn't aware of all the problems
that you are talking about.
That's all probably. We're not advising on valuation methods for the ISB.
No, that's more something that I will stop doing, calculating the net debt. It seems like a very difficult concept.
Actually, the ISB responded to your response because they made it two separate issues. So
they
must be...
Good.
Yes? Okay, Goro, please.
Okay, thank you. First of all, that the this cash and cash equivalent disclosure should be very useful. But I agree with Marietta. We need some kind of geographical breakdown, and require the preparers to disclose some kind of table, it shows a geographical breakdown, and on matrix, the geographical breakdown versus the parent subsidiary, and that kind of table should show that the actual location of cash, and parent or subsidiaries, and probably that we need similar type of table matrix for debts. If we do have both, then we can know that the query that, you know.
It's a kind of a mental communication here, because I was about to ask you, extend this question to CIMIC members, exactly what you said, as an additional input we want, because we have been hearing some of other feedback, and what I was going to ask is that if you think it would be useful, that exactly that kind of table. So if we have a table,
either by geographic or any other type of split for cash and for debt? Do you think it would be, maybe a silly question, but do you think it would be useful to have it? I mean, extremely useful.
Yeah, I think extremely useful. If the audit breakdowns are showing parent versus subsidiary.
Yeah.
Hold on, because for debt it is different, because geographic location of debt, I mean, that could be a Dutch financing company, you know? It doesn't tell you that much. It's about what the location is in a group structure.
So group structure?
Yeah, that's a key thing on the debt. And to be honest, if a company is operating in 80 jurisdictions, do you really want to have a table where we have 84 million here and this? And then I think the key thing that you want to communicate is maybe the nature of the restriction. Restriction, so we have 2.6 billion of cash, we lose 340 million due to NCI, we lose another 500 million on repatriation. We use, I think debt is more important, the nature of the restriction. We have covenants that restrict the upstreaming of cash, and that is responsible for another 200 million. I mean, it could end up that nil of the cash is really. I mean, it could be, and I'm not joking. I think the nature is much more relevant than a list of 80 geographies.
I will stop calculating net debt.
But that's a personal opinion. Martin, please.
When hearing all your comments, I have to say, man, that is only a narrow scope, man. And I think your expectation what this should achieve, I think, are very high. I fear that this narrow scope will not achieve that, because my eye thinking, when looking at group structures where you don't have a central treasury, and you assume it's all that at the parent level, that is maybe not the case. Maybe they have a European company has a US dollar treasury management sitting in New York. And in a subsidiary. So there are many kind of group structures, I think, which can have influence on this kind of view. And even if then the debt is sitting maybe in a subsidiary, and maybe then the cash is sitting in the same subsidiary. So if you have only the information based on the cash, but not on the where the debt is sitting, I think it is not very helpful. And I think really to achieve what you really want, I think that is maybe we have to think more in the broader disclosure project. Do we, for example, need more a kind of central liquidity statement where you have this kind of information? But with this narrow scope amendment, I have to say I fear that all your expectations may be not achieved. There is something on restrictions with cash, but what I'm hearing is then, okay, if it is then a 60% owned controlled subsidiary, maybe, and then maybe there is a treasury department, I think this narrow scope amendment cannot.
But this is basic. It's basic to. I mean, at the moment, I think the market is falsely assuming that all of the cash is available to the parent. Mm-hmm. And if you say that a billion dollar position is just.
But why with the parent? That is the first thing what I'm challenging. Because, for example, a big company, for example, which has all the operations in another currency. Region. They don't have the need, for example, that all this cash has to be available to the parent. It has to be available to the subsidiary because they have done their own debt.
But where do you pay dividends from in the end?
Yeah, but you want to charge liquidity, not dividends here, right?
Maybe you want to assess.
And that is my understanding. This narrow scope amendment is about liquidity, not dividend distribution.
It's liquidity in the parent in the end.
That is not my understanding.
Because if you leave it up to liquidity to wherever the cash is residing, all of the cash is available to wherever it is residing.
Yeah, but I'm. If I said my only point was, I think if you want to have it, okay, what is the liquidity available in the parent, maybe that would achieve that. But not overall liquidity, I think, from the group. Because that is, I think, the problem with the consolidated group accounts that you don't have 100%. What kind of subsidiaries in this?
Good. Robert, please.
So a couple of sort of comments. A well-run global treasury operation, I struggle with why they have cash and short-term borrowing. given the current interest rates, if you've got, you would never hold cash willingly. You would always use it to pay back short-term borrowing. So the moment I see cash, I've already got a red flag as why are they even holding that stuff? So there are some cases where good companies do hold cash. Certainly, if they have no short-term debt, then they should end up holding cash. But just that is a flag. The second question, we talked about liquidity. Liquidity is about cash versus debt. So it's really how much cash you have and short-term borrowings against your short-term claims. This is not supposed to be the end-all project. And I think to your point, this is not the end. As a sort of a stopgap. You know, we talked about, you know, the first section fine, the second section look, the spirit's in the right place. Just make sure that the people can't, you know, exclude these things that we care about. And then there's a long-term project, and it really talks about, and these are two words that you really need to become familiar with. Structural subordination means something. It's very specific. Either people understand what it means or they don't. And those who don't, it's shorthand for a whole very series of things. And similar to that is the waterfall concept, and those are interlinking concepts. And if you want to understand the debt and even the equity at a parent, if you don't understand the structural subordination and you don't understand waterfall, you don't have a clear equity picture of the company. Peter, I'd love to work in Sweden. Apparently, all your companies are nice and simple. I don't work
all
about
that. That's what they call.
Paolo, please.
Yeah, just one short comment, agreeing with your point in relation to foreign subsidiaries. In many, many cases, when you have your cash trapped there, there are political reasons for that. And definitely, the parent company or the CEO of your sub in Venezuela and Argentina will not be in a position to state clearly that I'll never get the money out of this country. So, and assuming that the ambassador of Venezuela to England will read Shell's balance sheet, you might like to see that in the balance sheet, saying the sketch is probably there and it's still there forever. So it's useless to take that. So the information, in summary, will not be reliable.
If you specify per individual country.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Conscious of the time for the taxonomy part.
Yeah.
You want to say something, Robert? Sorry. So let me best read that to the taxonomy part.
Good afternoon. And I think today is a day of first. The first time that IFRS taxonomy is included as a companion material to the exposure chart ourselves. And probably this is also the first time that we talk to you about the IFRS taxonomy. Now, I'm really happy. Don't know how many or even have heard about IFRS taxonomy, or aware of it, or I hope you may have had a look at it. Therefore, let me just start off with giving you a very simple definition of a taxonomy. So the IFRS taxonomy, you just have to say, look, it's a standard. It's a markup standard. Really, it gives you codes and to some extent a data model to tag an intelligent structure IFRS disclosures you find within the taxonomy file. I know that some investors find it very useful, some investors find it less useful. But what I don't want to do today is to discuss what are the pros and cons of electronic reporting. Today, I really want to focus on what are the proposed changes we are making to the IFRS taxonomy due process, and I would like to have some views on your back. If you're interested, at a later time, we can discuss pros and cons of electronic reporting. So if you move to slide 12, so there are two main changes we are proposing to make to the IFRS taxonomy due process. First of all, we have worked very much in the last couple of months to make the IFRS taxonomy content more transparent to the investors. Because in order to engage the investors first have to be able to understand what it's all about. And I think in the past we have linked the content of the IFRS taxonomy too much with its technology to make that many investors, but also prepared, really couldn't comment on the content of the IFRS taxonomy. to do that, we start producing what I would call a technology neutral document. And we call it the proposed ADRES taxonomy update. Now, on slide 15, I gave you an example of an extract of a proposed ADRES taxonomy update. It's very restrictive. I think I really suggest you read, if you're interested, the proposed ADRES taxonomy in the exposure draft. I mean, here I just want to simply illustrate that you do not need lots of knowledge to understand the ADRES taxonomy. Look, if you look, Vincent, at the highlighted figure of 250, what we do in the ADRES taxonomy, we give a code for it. We say, okay, this relates to the increase, decrease in financing cash flow, and it relates to a reporting category, financing components, and a particular element of that reporting category is long-term borrowings. So by combining two codes, long-term borrowings and increase to decrease through financing cash flows, the preparer can, to those investors who are interested in more in electronic access to data, explain what is the meaning of this 250. Yeah? And the proposed ADRES taxonomy explains the elements to be added, particular features, particular issues, etc. The second thing we have done, we have, and I have to stress this is on a trial only basis, we have now added this proposed, this document as a companion material to the exposure draft. And this material, the proposed ADRES taxonomy, has been reviewed and approved by the board. I want to stress it's a companion material, it's not an integral part of the standard. If you don't like it, you can ignore it. But for those investors who really look more at the data-centric view of the world or prefer to use electronic data, it could be useful for them. So what do you think, what do we think, to be honest first, what do we think are the benefits to investors? I think some investors, especially data aggregators, but also some credit rating agencies, have told us by seeing all these disclosures modeled in a different way than just in a textual format, they find it useful to understand the ADRES disclosure requirements. They may also find it useful when they want to model their new ADRES taxonomy ADRES disclosure requirements within their internal models or within the feeds that data aggregators are providing. Also, you probably be aware that many regulators are currently considering the mandating of an electronic filing system. That ESMA is very close to publishing a consultation paper on this, and it's probably going to happen somewhere in 2015. So it's very important for us to say that we need and get feedback from investors on the content. Because so far we have done, if there's a particular disclosure in the standard, we have put it in our taxonomy. But we want feedback. Do you think that disclosure needs to be tagged? Is it unlikely you're going to ever put that in a data model? You look at more as narrative explanatory when you review the data. Is the labels, can you make sense of these labels? Can you make sense of the codes? Should we maybe merge particular elements together? Because since at the moment in our taxonomy, we have tax for each individual accounting policies. That is, to tag all that information incurs a cost to prepare. Is that really what you want? Or do you say, look, one tag would be sufficient? Now, I know we have run out of time, so at this moment in time, I will not ask you questions about slide 14.
Can I ask the team, because you're all part of the same team, if you want to ask questions and take time off the second presentation?
I spent some time here on this.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
You have some flexibility.
Yeah. So, I at the moment, I'm ignoring slide 14. Yeah. So, I want to focus first on the question on slide 16. So, it's a general question. Do you believe that including the proposed ADRES taxonomy as a companion material to the exposure draft or standard is a good step towards involving investors? Or do you recommend additional actions we should take?
I think you've heard Peter.
Well, I think this is extremely important, this work. Having spent a number of years working for a firm where I think part of our competitive advantage was having an internal system that was built on an own taxonomy, this is extremely important. And it would allow us to avoid a lot of discussions of disclosure versus recognition, because ultimately it would give us a tool to do our work. Now, having done this in practice for a number of years, this is a very difficult process as well. So I'm not going to comment on the process, but you probably will have to think through very carefully how you're going to manage this. To set up is one thing, but then the managing of this thing. But this is very, very important. I think this is key. So.
Dan, please. I had a comment and a question. I completely agree. We use the U.S. taxonomy every day at our firm, and it's incredibly helpful. It saves an incredible amount of time. It also updates immediately after the filing comes through, which if you use any of the other databases, there is a very long lag sometimes, which is frustrating. The problem I have with the IF, with the international community is I don't know what I'm supposed to do with the information right now. There's nowhere to collect it. I don't know who. It's very sort of, I'm not sure I understand. So I guess my question is, before you sort of putting the cart before the horse by putting out a taxonomy before there's investors aren't going to get excited about it if there's nowhere that they can go and see the data, and you know, so I don't know, like maybe you have to get, you know, one of the regulatory bodies to mandate it or something, but you know, because I tried to get, you know, some of our people in London to look more into it, and it was just incredibly hard for them to figure out, you know, where to start, because there's no mandates. So what I'm saying is, before you really push it out to investors, maybe have a way to have a little more systematized program where you can, maybe a sampling of companies, and you can have it in a database just so they can see the efficacy of it.
That's a good point, Dan, and it's really, we are aware of it, and so therefore our focus at the moment is very much on supporting regulators to give them the right kind of support, but we also realize that if you put the whole taxonomy in one go to investors, it's very overwhelming, and maybe to put the taxonomy at the same time as when you consider an exposure draft or consider a spender, it may be probably less overwhelming. So that's what we are out of the first initial.
Yeah, I guess that was kind of my question. So are you saying when there's a standard that comes out, you would attach a taxonomy to it, but then the taxonomy is one thing, but then the ability to pull the data is the next thing. Where do you get the data from, even if there's a taxonomy? And that's, I guess,
that's what I consider the setup cost. We think that's coming. The USCCC.
If there's a mandate, then there'll be a market for it. You know what I mean? If there's a mandate, then there'll be third-party firms to come in and do it. I mean, in the U.S. now there's more of these terms than needed.
Globally, we're doing a thing called jurisdictional profiles, like we did for standards. We're doing the same thing for electronic filing requirements. So we're trying to find out who's mandating electronic filing to start with, and whether structured data, and are they using our taxonomy? Because it varies around the world, whether you go to Australia, Korea, and other different places, for example. And Israel has a subset. So we've got different flavors around the place. The biggest push, I think, will come from the US and then Europe. They may come about the same time, but the SEC staff are strongly supportive of our taxonomy and requiring the foreign filers to actually use our taxonomy. So that would give you 450, 500 or so to start with. But then Europe is doing that assessment from 2020. So that will come, but this is a long game.
Okay. Marietta?
Yes, I think the main value for me would really be if I can use this as a relational database to pull data into my model. So I basically type the code into my model once, put some sort of a reference to the year or whatever, and then I just kind of pull across from 2002 to 2015, give me the DPS, the pension, and so forth. And of course, I mean, I think what it would also really facilitate is if we have restatements for prior periods because of a change in accounting policy or whatever, you would then not have to go back and change it all manually. You could just probably, I mean, I guess this is how it would work or how it should work, just press the refresh button. One question I have on your slide number 15 is, a lot of times companies change a little bit the way they lump things together. So you gave this example here with the 250. So what if in the prior year period they had actually, in the accounts they've shown, us lumped together long-term borrowings and lease liabilities? Would that then mean that, you know, if I basically use that same formula that gives me the 250 for this year, for last year, it gives me nothing? I basically get no return because this didn't exist last year? And
that depends, I think, Marietta. Look, if a company had put long-term borrowings and lease liabilities together and no disaggregation, yeah, then yes, if you now just put in long-term borrowings, you wouldn't get anything because the company hadn't disclosed it. If you would, if the company had last year had said long-term borrowings and lease liabilities and disaggregated, and this year they put them together, yeah, in principle, when the company types that information, they would have used two different codes. Whether it would be relatively simple for a tool or a database to say, look, if you have these two elements together, do now a simple aggregation. Even better would be if a preparer would declare that relationship within their time. So, because when we talk about electronic reporting, we don't only talk about time. Like we feel as well, relationships and declarations of things that you normally see in a physical report, you may have to declare differently in the electronic report. And that is going to take some time, I think, for so many people there to get that.
Because I mean, just the really important point for me is I think, you know, I think I would only use it if I really can use it to automate processes. If I have to actually manually go in and type each of these codes, it's probably easier to just flip to the right page in the PDF document.
And I think that's what, as a user, you have an also very important role. You could declare that you're prepared, say, look, for me, for your electronic filing to be useful, it would be very good if you just provide me a relationship. How the
two
elements
relate
to each other.
Barbara.
Mm-hmm. Ask a quick question. I know you've got it. The two supporters, you're talking about whether it's mandated. You know, if there's a mandate, there may be more interest in this. But which one, do investors need to indicate the need for this to become more interesting for regulators to mandate? Is it a chicken egg thing?
Well, it's kind of, I mean, I would think it's kind of a no-brainer for investors. I mean, it's better.
Yeah.
Higher quality data, in a more timely manner.
And it opens up the way, again, people in this room do a lot of homework, redoing the numbers and all this stuff. This helps the broader audience to sort of do similar things, and it's key. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, whether you're a quant or a fundamental analyst, the thing you struggle with current data providers is they tend to try to standardize things.
Yes.
So, like the example that I was just given, if the disclosure was changed, you have some kind of guy that works at Reuters giving his own interpretation of how it should look, whereas with the tagging, yeah, it changed, but you would see the two separate tags, and then you can sort of combine them. So
right.
it's just better data. So
it's raw material, right, as opposed
right.
to already something that has been digested by somebody else.
Right.
So does the investment community need to kind of speak up more about this to be able to get this passed through, through the regulators?
Just do it.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but do it well. Do it well.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge.
It's one of the criticisms of XBRL or what the structure is that nobody's using it or people don't use it. And so there seems to be this negative thinking, perception.
Well, that's why I would say don't move too quickly, because I think there was an initial affinity for it in the U.S., and then it just took so long to get it to be anything that anybody could use. You know, everything from the companies not knowing how to tag things to the data providers not knowing how to pull the data, but it's much better now. The guys that we work with say that the demand is increasing, but I mean, it's in their interest to say that. So I don't know, I would maybe just talk to some of the providers and see.
But it's also an example where, by eventually the SEC stabilizing the data, trying to get some discipline around the tagging, and so they, now that it's stable, people going and pulling off the database.
Right.
And before, the trouble is if you talk to investors and they have different needs, and you just can't get anything stabilized there. So
yeah.
I decided that it's the key for us is to get the regulators satisfied and stable, the discipline's there, and you can then go.
It will be great to see all the non-GAAP metrics then being expressed in the taxonomy.
Okay, hold on a bit. I think we all experience that the most common way to analyze your company is just to manually open up the annual report and type over the numbers. I mean, and we're talking 2014, 2015. Well, I mean, it's for many people, or you use a third-party data provider, and then you lose exactly what Dan is saying. You end up with, or you start with, standardized data, whereas, I mean, it sounds like completely unnecessary. I think it's just that to get going, it takes a huge amount of effort where, indeed, maybe also not many investors will say, well, I will use it, because they would probably need to see how Dan is using it in practice before they say, well, yes, that's what I want. Maybe you can make a YouTube video, Dan, of how easy...
just be my screen.
Yeah.
You enjoy
a tangible example. And the only thing I'd like to add is the question in the ED was, for someone who's not familiar with XBRL, a bit abstract. So it's very difficult. What are you really asking for the stakeholders to comment on? And maybe it needs some sort of a link to, okay, what are we talking about? The context is a bit, it's like the easy one to skip, and it's probably not what you want. Gary, please.
Just one quick comment. In the U.S., one of the reasons why it took a while to catch on is, first of all, you need several years in it. But also, the SEC never finished the job because the management commentary is not in it. And so no matter what, you can either go to a data aggregator or some other information source or the MD&A, or you keep punching it yourself. So the only stuff that's in it is the historical, the classical primary statements and footnotes. So it's incomplete as it is. So any discussion with regulators and all almost has to go, when are you going to finish the job and go cover to cover? And that's a huge limitation, I think, in terms of its ultimate usefulness.
Yeah, that's a good point, because you can't replace your existing data with XBRL for that exact reason, because you still need the data that comes from the MD&A.
And the focal point of your analysis.
Right, exactly.
You're still going to need other multiple documents.
Okay.
So just to summarize, going back on AS7, we jumped the April due date for comment letters. So all we discuss here, and if you have more disclosures, you think, as we discuss here, to ask for and suggest to make it to comment letters until April this year. So please submit comment letters to us to support that.
Yep.
Remember,
good,
this is a short-term
useful
amendment. There are not many covered.
You can make comments on the comment letter, and we direct them to a short project.